Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies, African Studies Center, titled On Whose Terms? African Women and Politics of Recognition in the International Refugee Regime. Our speaker is Emily Doof, Assistant Professor of English at Brandeis University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Edouard Boustan.
Our speaker today is Emily Doof of Brandeis University. Emily got her first education in her native country of Senegal at the Université Cheikh Anta Diop, and then she got a Fulbright to come to the United States and went to MSU, where she got an MA and her PhD. Now, her work is largely devoted to the issue of women in politics, and she is working on a book of which today's presentation will be a chapter. She already has, in fact, two articles published this year and the year before on a similar subject. So we're glad to welcome Emily Doof as our speaker today.
Thank you to Professor Boustan for inviting me and to the BU African Studies Center for including me in the long tradition of engagement with Africa. And I am very honored to be here and to share part of an evolving project and welcome your comments, suggestions, and questions at the end. So this is part of a large... I should mention that I slightly changed my title into Who Counts in Crisis, because I think at the beginning of this talk I want to play a little bit around problematizing this issue of crisis or the temporality of crisis, what is usually referred to as the migrant crisis or the global migrant crisis. So part of a bit of a background of where this project fits in. So the book project really seeks to think about trauma. So I am trying to expand the field of trauma studies and trauma theory by including more substantially the experiences of African women. And so in that, I think it's important to attune psychoanalytical readings of trauma with the social, political context of the traumatic event. And so in that, I'm hoping that, you know, we'll widen the notion of trauma to include it in post-colonial African studies, though, because there is still kind of a hesitance in coupling trauma and post-colonialism. So to begin, I'll start reading. As some European countries and the U.S. contend with the so-called influx of migrants from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, shocking tales of women and children drowning in the Mediterranean Sea are portrayed over and over by media networks worldwide. However, the distress of refugees landing in Europe has overshadowed the efforts of African countries who've been grappling with forced displacement since the 1960s. Commenting on the long durée of African refugee crisis, Adherante Adepuju writes, I quote, "In 1967, when the first meeting on refugees in Africa took place in Addis Ababa under the auspices of the Organization of African Unity and other agencies, which held 2 years later to the adoption of the OAU member states of the convention governing aspect of refugee problem in Africa, there were no more than 750,000 refugees and displaced persons in Africa. A little after a decade later, when the Pan-African Conference on the Situation of Refugees was held in Arusha, Tanzania in May 1979, the number of refugees had vastly increased to about 4 million. That is more than the combined population of 7 African countries, namely Gambia, Swaziland, Gabon, Namibia, Botswana, Djibouti, and Mauritius. This deteriorating situation has been caused by violence, natural disasters, and cyclical political crises in the Great Lakes region, Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia, etc." End of quote. Excuse me. While European nations seek to limit access to economic migrants and asylum seekers, countries like Ethiopia and Uganda, for example, are taking in thousands of refugees from neighboring countries. In the Central African refugees, clashes among rival groups have forced thousands to flee their home. In Nigeria, more than 2 million people have been forcibly displaced, including 1.7 million who have fled from the militant group Boko Haram violence since 2014. Some 95,000 people have sought refuge in neighboring countries, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Ethiopia hosts nearly 740,000 refugees, mostly from Somalia, Eritrea, Sudan, and South Sudan, the largest refugee population in a single African country. More than 5,000 refugees from Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and South Sudan have settled in Uganda. And let's not forget that Uganda has been struggling to integrate its own internally displaced people, namely former child soldiers, who were held captive by Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army. According to the United Nations, developing countries, mostly in Africa, are taking in disproportionate number of refugees, currently over 20% of the world refugee population. In countries with low coping capacity and weak governance, the majority of people internally displaced live in conditions of extreme vulnerability and are often at risk of experiencing further violence. This is the case for many of the 12.6 million internally displaced Africans as of 2016. In this dire and clearly worsening situation, oftentimes the gendered facets of forced displacement are not prioritized. Therefore, both my intervention here and my research in general seek to stress the need to highlight a neglected yet important population of forcibly displaced African women and sexual minorities, whose voices are especially important in times of growing xenophobic, misogynistic populism. Bare life on the edge of the state of exception, as Membe wrote, African women refugees and sexual minority extend to our present time what Walter Benjamin's prediction that the 20th century will be marked by those spaces where people who have been denied human dignity will leave out their lives barely existing under the power of the sovereign, whose rule over them had no check. There is no doubt that intersectional feminism has several times throughout its trajectory turned the sovereign on its head. Susanna Rudson, for example, and Judith Butler point out the far-reaching consequences of theories and paradigms that support politicized construction of those with whom identification via suffering can be forged, and those from whom such identification are withheld. According to Butler, in Frames of War, When Life is Grievable, I quote, the differential distribution of grievability across population has implications for why and when we feel politically consequential affective dispositions such as horror, guilt, righteous sadism, loss, and indifference. This differential distribution of precarity is at once a material and perceptual issue, since those whose lives are not regarded as potentially grievable and hence valuable are made to bear the burden of starvation, underemployment, legal disenfranchisement, and differential exposure to violence and death, end of quote. Patricia Hill Collins in 1998 drew attention to the epistemological problem of framing the lives of marginalized groups, which is similar to what Butler tries to articulate, through her notion of frames as a vehicle through which we apprehend or indeed fail to apprehend the lives of others as lost or endured. Hill Collins puts it this way: oppressed groups are frequently placed in a situation of being listened to only if we frame our ideas in the language that is familiar to and comfortable for a given discipline. This requirement often changes the meaning of our ideas and works to support the ideological position of a certain discipline. How do we explain situations in which some forms of suffering are recognized only to be compounded while other forms of suffering remain invisible? When the victims of trauma are already peripheral, disempowered members of society, such as African women refugees, The traumatic experiences they endure are often perceived within a racial, gender, linguistic schema. In what Roger Lackhouse calls our contemporary trauma culture, I quote, a set of affective dispositions and publishing norms that promote aesthetic engagement with the pain of others. International women's human rights advocates have made trauma narration central to the definition of particular activist agendas and priorities. While one could argue that identity politics are still privileged as key for understanding differences, alliances, tensions, and tensions, trauma remains the usher of transnational women's movement. In their discussion of the kinds of solidarity that are often born out of reading and listening to trauma stories, Nancy Miller and Jason Tugow have rightfully pointed out that trauma has become the portmanteau that covers a multitude of disparate injuries. The trauma narrative's potential, as we can all see, has through activist resistance in much African women's movement and against gender violence specifically, have really garnered some collective and at the individual level have garnered results so that claims by activist groups could be met locally, nationally, and internationally. While African women refugees make use of this constructive power of trauma narrative, there is a tension between the need to have their suffering known and recognized by others and the risk associated with speaking out. Here I call on Linda Alcoff and Laura Gray, who have shown that while, I quote, the act of speaking out in and of itself transform power relations and subjectivities, or the very way in which we experience and define ourselves, bringing things into the realm of discourse works also to inscribe them into hegemonic structures and to produce docile self-monitoring bodies who willingly submit themselves to and thus help to create and legitimate the authority of experts. End of quote. Interacting contextual factors impact the various ways in which other people's pain migrates from a particular symbolic order or symbolic register to another. Kay Schaefer and Sidona Smith's reflection on the use of storytelling in human rights advocacy highlight the complex matrix of recounting the experiences of pain, the perils of interpretation and circulation in advocacy work. All stories emerge in the midst of complex and uneven relations of power, prompting certain questions about production. So these are questions adapted from Smith and Schaefer, and I wonder specifically about the implications when it comes to displaced African women. Who tells the stories and who doesn't? To whom are they told and under what circumstances? Why, when, how? And where do narratives become intelligible as stories of human rights? How do modes of circulation impact the expectation of the teller, the structure of the story, and the modes of address to different kinds of audience? How are stories taken up in legal aesthetic domains? How do stories in circulation invite conflicting responses? Among them, empathetic identification, political advocacy, apathy, and backlash, some of which exceed, some of which frustrate the desires of tellers for recognition and redress. On one hand, Schaefer and Smith underscore the mechanism through which the modes of production and reception of trauma stories may have an impact upon the effective circuit. And on the other hand, they point to the challenges of accountability with respect to the survivor. They give us insights into the core of what often results in the making of a framework of witnessing that props up a subject of rights who is recognizable through its capacity to denounce, expose, and destabilize structures that create vulnerability. Since, in the words of Fellman, it is imperative that we, I quote, we act as a cultural and political witness who turns trauma as experience into insight and whose innovative concept enable the creation of new tools with which to think cross-culturally. And attuned to the spirit of Molara Agundipe calls for more refined analytical tools for perceiving African women, I suggest that recognition of trauma can only happen if there is a willingness to ethically translate other people's pain. Ethical translation of pain takes into account the intersubjective dimension of trauma narration and considers the cultural, social, and political location of African women, as well as the subject who bear witness to their testimonies. The concept of ethical translation discussed here informs my thinking about ownership of trauma, appropriation, and commodification of pain, especially when mediated by the aesthetic register or technologies of representation often deployed by advocacy work. Therefore, the concept of ethical translation posits that cross-cultural trauma alliances to be formed, we need to be cognizant that recognition is a formative process in which images and meanings of pain are inseparable from the position of the subject who bear witness to trauma. We relate to others through our frames of reference, including what we read or see, so we only recognize what is familiar to us. Because of this, we often find what Butler calls ethical violence. Then, in the name of our frames of reference and action, which are founded on a given place of a social structure, we validate a trauma story based on these parameters. The value judgment, according to Butler, does not lie in founding an ethical relationship, nor does it involve recognition, but in fact act as fast track to formulate an ontological difference between judge and judge. In this sense, the displaced African woman who's the locus of traumatic address acquires representational features that oftentimes objectifies her in terms of her vulnerability and dependency, which becomes easily identifiable with otherness. The question of why African women refugees endure this kind of violence, which is very persistent and recurrent in popular global activist right discourse, reflects the limited or partial recognition of the reality of abuse that leads to ethical violence. By imposing our cultural patterns, we forget to speak with the survivor and may even, in the process, fail to bring any improvement to the condition that engendered the traumatic event. Ethical translation means questioning the epistemic position from which we articulate recognition. For Oliver, the dichotomy between subject and other and between subject and object is, in itself, a pathology of oppression, since it enables the dehumanization inherent in oppression and domination. Ethical translation implies, therefore, recognizing the cultural specificity of the trauma and agency of survivors without subsuming them to what is familiar to the witness reader of the traumatic account. Ethical translation moves closer to Spivak's notion of plurivocality in Death of the Discipline as a way to emphasize the diversity and complexity of experience as opposed to difference. Plurivocality means allowing the subjectivities of the trauma text to stand on their own while simultaneously establishing connection across traumatic experiences, readers, theories, and cultures. Therefore, ethical translation means that theorizing recognition and cross-cultural solidarity in trauma theory has to be situated outside what Spivak calls the totalizing interpretative act. There are forms of critical violation. The term translation here both literally and figuratively refers to the movement through which African women's trauma experiences are represented in language, mediated, reproduced, and read in human rights activism. Translation, in this sense, refers to the mechanisms through which African women refugee stories migrate from the realm of subjective expression of pain and psychological anguish to different stages of encounters with others who bear witness to these stories. From the first utterance of pain to its institutional recording, medical or judicial, through its translation into different languages and its entrance and circulation into race discourse. The story of the African refugee woman goes through multiple interpretations, which involves an awareness or lack thereof of the context of language and culture for both the survivor and the audience that witnesses her story. Translation has often been held up as a benevolent metaphor for imagining and learning the position of others. But when the relationship between the languages involved are unequal, translation can strengthen the inherited inequalities that might have led to the traumatic event. Hence the figurative meaning of translation here, which takes into consideration the ways in which the interactive dynamics between the context of trauma, narration, and the conditions of reception play into the reading interpretation attached to the African women refugees trauma narrative. Refugee resettlement procedures and truth reconciliation commissions are good examples of the ways in which the figurative meaning of translation is invested in particular encounter and the kinds of knowledge held by an audience, but also in intertextual references that an audience brings to work in these institutional spaces. And so to all this theoretical blurb, we'll come to a concrete thing now as I give examples from two case studies. So in June 1996, specific June 13, Fozia Kasinja, a 17-year-old Togolese-born young woman who fled excision and a forced polygamous marriage with an older man, was granted asylum by the U.S. highest immigration court, the Board of Immigration Appeals. The victory over Kasinja's case, referred to as Matter of Kasinga, broke ground as it was the very first time the United States refugee law recognized gender-based persecution and ruled that women who suffer violation of their rights, of their human rights, could be granted relief. In its 2006 annual report commemorating the 10th year anniversary of Matter of Kasinga and not the change of name from Kasinja to Kasinga, and so just a bit of a parenthesis here, upon her arrival at the Newark International Airport from London, Fozia had a British passport that she had bought from a young Nigerian guy in Germany. And so he instructed her that once you go, I mean, the U.S. is a country of freedom and relief, so just go to the airport, hand the passport, and say you are asking for asylum. And so Kasinja was taken away and interrogated, and so through the interrogation process, that's when she was being recorded officially by an immigration official who misspelled her name as Kasinga. The interesting fact is that Kasinga participated in that mistranslation because she was right there, but there's an internal dialogue going on. Should I correct her? Is it rude? Or should I even tell her that I fled from Kakia, which is female genital cutting? And so it's really interesting that in the U.S., through her asylum case, she becomes Kasinga instead of Kasinja, and she let herself written into that. So in its 2006 annual report commemorating the 10-year anniversary of Matter of Kasinga, the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at the University of California, Hastings, remarked that this landmark decision, I quote, reverberated around the world, influencing judges in many other countries and even causing the elders of Togo to consider whether the practice of female genital cutting should be reconsidered, end of quote. The Board of Immigration Appeals ruling came after Kasinja spent almost 2 years in detention in four maximum security prisons. During her time in jail, she was strip searched so many times, shackled in chains from head to foot, and put in a solitary confinement for over 2 weeks following her misdiagnosis with tuberculosis. Of course, she was from Togo, from Africa, so she had a bit of a stomach upset and then was put in confinement because she brought diseases, of course, with her. Kasinja had been denied asylum by Judge Donald Furlis, who is known for his abusive attitude toward asylum seekers. Judge Furlis refused to grant relief to Kasinja because he found her story not credible. He also ruled that even if her story was true, her fear of female genital cutting was not a basis for relief. Shortly after Judge Furlis's denial of Kasinga's claim, she found a new legal team, which she refers to in her memoir, based on the case, as Fuzia Team, comprised of Leila Miller Bashir, then a law student at American University who had represented Kasinga at her first appearance in Judge Furlis's immigration court. Karen Musalo, the director for the Center of Gender and Refugee Studies, and Richard Boswell, both asylum law experts. They happened to be teaching at American University at the time. Having considered that Judge Furlis's order to deport Kasinga back to Togo, where she feared she would undergo FGM, was a form of injustice, Miller Bashir appealed to the expertise of her professors at the International Human Rights Clinic at American University. Commenting on the dire circumstances that led her to be involved, Karen Musalo indicates, I quote, by this time, Kasinga had spent almost a year in detention under difficult conditions. She had lived through a prison riot during which she was tear gassed and beaten and was suffering from severe gastrointestinal disorders with inadequate medical attention, end of quote. Kasinga's mental and physical health were so affected that she decided it would be better to return to Togo and suffer excision than spend another day in the U.S. Kasinga's trauma story brought the issue of female genital cutting to U.S. feminist activist circles and to national consciousness. Her legal team sought to frame a case in ways that would resonate with women's rights and human rights constituencies, who would then provide strong support for her asylum claim if they were educated on the issue. So they set about to bring Kasinga's case into the court of public opinion. They sought to build a public discourse in favor of protecting Kasinga. In order to bring sympathetic media attention to her case, they collaborated with Equality Now, a women's rights act organization that had the support of Washington Post columnist Judy Mann. The Center for Gender and Refugee Studies reports that on January 19, 1996, under the heading of When Judge Fail, Judy Mann wrote a searing indictment of Judge Furlis's decision. Mann's column referred to his extravagant display of ignorance and eloquently argued for Kasinga's release from detention, commenting that she was, quote, the kind of person we should want to protect, not further persecute, end of quote. Mann's column caught the eye of another journalist, Linda Burstein, who wrote an even lengthier opinion piece on the case. The piece was titled Asylum in America, Does Fear of Female Genital Mutilation Qualify? It was published on March 17, 1996, in the Sunday edition of the Washington Post. After criticizing Judge Furlis's decision as, quote, inconceivable, nonsensical, and irrational, end of quote, and asking why Fuzia Kasinga should be made to, I quote, languish in a Pennsylvania prison, she took on the floodgate argument of those who were not favorable to Kasinga's claim. Bernstein's opinion piece is worth quoting at length because it demonstrates how Kasinga's advocates sought to strategically steer public opinion in her favor by circulating Kasinga's story as a transnational discourse of protection for a defenseless African teenager girl who is victimized by an extremely violent tribal cultural practice, she writes, I quote, there are many who fear that if women like Kasinga are granted asylum, female circumcision will become a new special category within immigration law. They say that the United States cannot be expected to help everyone and must not in cases like this because they fear hordes of third world women would be crashing our gates begging to be let in. This claim is both wrong and beside the point. As Karen Musalo points out, the question is not should we make allowances for FGM. The question is, do we or don't we have a commitment in our laws to protect people who flee persecution? We are not asking for special consideration. We are asking for protection under laws that are already there. End of quote. Within days of the appearance of Kasingya's horrible detention story, the government agreed to release her. She walked out of the York County prison to find hordes of reporters and photographers. As a result, Fuzia Kasingya's quest for protection as a refugee became one most highly publicized political asylum case since the passage of the 1980 Refugee Act. She was interviewed by Ted Koppel on Nightline, Barbara Bradley of National Public Radio, and Judy Wardroff on CNN. Describing the publicity of Kasingya's case, Celia Dagger from the New York Times recalls, "She was flooded by calls from book publishers, Hollywood producers. She was toasted by women's refugee advocates at a swanky luncheon at the United Nations. Gloria Steinem, feminist icon, invited Kasingya to her home. Miss Kasingya has become a hot property. In August, she signed a 600,000 book contract with Delacorte Press, a New York publisher. She's likely to get more than half the money, with the rest going to her agent, freelance writer, and Miss Miller Bashir, who worked on the case as a law student. A movie deal is sure to follow." End of quote. By the time Kasingya's legal team argued her case to the Board of Immigration Appeal, most of the U.S. had already heard about the plight of the teenage girl from Togo, although a proponent of the floodgates argument vocally expressed that she should not be granted relief and ought to be sent back to Togo. There was an overwhelming group of sympathizers whose perception of her as a brave and admirable African teenage girl was in favor of Kasingya. 10 years after the matter of Kasingya, then this is the other case I'm describing, Mrs. Gundo, a 20-year-old Soninke woman from Mali, must persuade an immigrant judge that her 2-year-old daughter, Jenabu, born in the U.S., will almost certainly suffer excision if Gundo is deported. The film proceeds with statistics, or the story is, as in Kasingya's case, is made into a film. So the film proceeds with statistics of the number of women that undergo excision. We learn that in Mali, 85% of women and girls are excised, and Mrs. Gundo and her husband are convinced they would be powerless to protect their daughter from her well-intentioned grandparents, who believe all girls should be excised. Mrs. Gundo's legal battle is captured by Barbara Atti and Janet Goldwater's film, the film by the name of the subject, Mrs. Gundo's Daughter, and it was released in 2009, was broadcasted in February 2011 and won, I think, two or three human rights awards. The filmmaker used cinematic juxtaposition to undercut Gundo's asylum hearing with a mass female circumcision in an unnamed village in Mali. In the U.S., we know that Mrs. Gundo lives in Philadelphia, but in Mali, the mass circumcision is in an undamed village. We have no idea, which makes it seem like it's all over the country, happening every day at every minute. Mrs. Gundo and the filmmakers negotiate cinematic space to turn her experience in the immigration court into what Bill Nichols calls, I quote, personal portrait documentary that captures the socio-cultural condition that caused Gundo and her husband to fear deportation. So what the film doesn't say is that Mrs. Gundo was in the U.S. She came to the U.S. when she was 15 to be delivered to her husband, to whom she was betrothed at the age of 4. And so at 15, she couldn't apply for asylum. So, but the story is really, if you read between the line, it's that she overstayed her visa and had 2 children, and didn't come forward until the birth of her daughter. And so when her daughter turned 3 months, she decided to file for asylum. So, of course, the time limit to asylum application, which is a year after arrival or a year after the person becomes an adult, had passed. And by the time she applied, she was 22. So that was a problem in the statute and jurisdiction and jurisprudence of her case. But the film doesn't really capture this agency that the woman had in kind of working around the legal system in order to kind of overturn her status of being undocumented. And Mrs. Gindo's husband was in the U.S. for, I think, 20 years and were undocumented. So it is really until the birth of their daughter, Jainabu, that they thought it was the way for us to really start navigating this legal system through asylum. And so the projection of the mother's scarred body, because in the film we learn that Mrs. Gindo, we learn through the official voice of her doctor, her gynecologist, that she was excised. And so she proposed to write a letter to support her asylum case. And so the asylum was around the fact that Mrs. Gindo's daughter would undergo FGM if she were to go back to Mali. So the personal portrait documentaries, as Bill Nichols defines it, is really the kind of film, especially documentary films, that heavily rely on style to produce poetic and subjective discourse where personal experience is valued. And here, Mrs. Gindo's experience is valued through the expertise of her doctor, but her daughter's experience is projected through the 62 little girls who are going through FGM, through excision in the scene. And so there's like horrific scene with really exaggerated camera zoom and slow down to really make us, be kind of shocked by the images, and not just for Mrs. Gindo, but especially for her daughter, who it is kind of her images juxtaposed with images of kids the same age who are going through the practice and had just went through the surgery. So Mrs. Gindo's daughter bridges two worlds. In a Malian village, we see 62 girls, 6 months to 10 years old, preparing to be excised. So that was the... just as their mothers, sisters, and aunts, grandmothers were before them. The girls are warned they must be brave and not cry, although, as one mother tells us, the pain is very deep. There is nothing we can do to lessen it. We hear Malian activists fighting to end the practice and traditionalists who defend it. We see its deep root in the intersection between Islam, Soninke customs, and belief. The publicity of both of these cases has great symbolic significance for exploring the trauma narrative's ability to foster cross-cultural understanding. The media discourse that surrounded Kissinger's case raise questions not only about the cross-cultural mediation of African women's trauma, stories and advocacy work, but also about the interface of trauma, feminist politics, and right discourse. The media discourse, as well as the memoir and film about these cases, offer a rich opportunity to reflect on the trauma theory's concept of recognition and cross-cultural solidarity as it relates to the specific ways in which stories of African women refugees are discursively represented, read, and appropriated in global feminist and human rights activism. The mediatization of both cases not only provoke further questioning of what kind of African women's traumatic experience get attention from certain technologies of representation, it also raises the question of how African women's stories get installed into global human rights discourse as knowledge and evidence. In the process of assuring the international recognition of the efforts to bring awareness to FGM and its broader implication, as well as link it to other gender-based violence, such as domestic abuse and rape, African feminist movement against FGC sought to align with other groups working to eradicate violence against women globally. As transnational alliances grew, questions of sovereignty and agency arose, of course. The notion of sovereignty, which was at one time associated with the nation state, the right to govern without external influence, became a debate over who has the right to condemn and name a social group's cultural practice. the portrayal of female genital cutting as a manifestation of how African women's traumatic experience become intelligible and translatable as global women's human rights abuses led to vibrant discussion about the implication of circulating distant traumatic practices in transnational feminist activism. The contentious debate about the appropriate naming of female excision demonstrates that despite alliances, it is difficult to find consensus around the perfect term with which to describe the procedure and its problematic existence without ostracizing those who practice it. So in the film, there is an attempt to just convey different perspective on excision, but with the filmmakers really attempting to kind of remove themselves from it. But we see, of course, through camera movement, through editing, but also through the activist discourse, who in a way displaced the filmmakers, that indeed there is a point where the practice is ostracized. So while this film appeared to embody trauma theory's notion of recognition and cross-cultural solidarity by these filmmakers, really engaging in consciousness raising and teaching, the location of the rhetoric from a position of privilege, supposedly culture-free, undermines ethical translation. African women's trauma stories enable these filmmakers to formulate their own feminist politics that are grounded on liberal transnational feminist geopolitics. And yet the stories are important. So when Muntaga Traore says, I don't want anybody to see this, he undermines histories of silencing women's experiences of violence. But yet, so how do we withstand the vicissitude of witnessing and really the fact of speaking in and out that kind of exposes ones to getting their stories appropriated, recorded in codes that may not really do what the intended story or the intended communication of the experience, its original intention. So here I'm just going to end briefly by talking about geopolitics here. And I used it in this idea that in order for us to appreciate the extent of the severity of Mrs. Gindo's potential deportation, we have to see actual scenes of, even though we don't see the actual ceremony, of the scenes from the actual excision ceremony are displaced and replaced by the sketch drawing in the courtroom. So in a way, conflating the two experiences, that the courtroom testimony of Mrs. Gindo, it's like we cannot hear Mrs. Gindo on her own terms without actually seeing the affectively kind of distressed faces of these children the age of her daughter in Mali. So Eily Tripp's interpretation of the meaning of transnational feminism in the context of the interaction between the North and diverse movement concerned with women's human rights, South-based feminism, and gender allied social justice shows how Grewal notion of geopolitics is predominant in U.S. feminist activism with a transnational orientation. According to Tripp, the term transnational feminism is sometimes used as a shorthand for Western involvement in and influence on feminist movements globally, end of quote. The shorthand often only portrays the North as a source of dynamic transnational feminist organizing. Therefore, transnational feminist geopolitics provokes difficult questions about agency and control. This film, as well as Kissinger's memoir, Do They Hear You When You Cry, play a constitutive role in the development and maintenance of trauma portfolios. You know, each document, photo, affidavit, letter provided by the local, national, and international institution, or in this case, by the filmmakers who have the political capital to affirm the authenticity of Mrs. Gindo's suffering, added to the value of a portfolio within a transnational human rights advocacy discourse. As Françoise Lyonnais has already pointed out in different contexts, women writers are specifically aware of their task as producers of image, that both participate in the dominant representation of their cultures and simultaneously undermine and subvert those images by offering a revision of the familiar script. The value of Kasinja and Mrs. Gindo's trauma portfolio lies in their supporters' ability to strategically exploit America's racialized beliefs of Black of Africa in order to ensure positive claim outcome. I'll end here so we can have a discussion. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for this very interesting presentation containing many truths, I think, and many provocative questions, thought-provoking questions as well as perhaps provocative. I imagine that when you're putting together the presentation and the chapter and the book, and one is very interested to hear what's in the other chapters of the book, is there some presentation of the broader context in which these acts of focus take part? In one book published several years ago on a female initiation sequence in Kenya as it happened, there are about 600 pages of context containing the before, the after, the songs, the dances, the marches, the stories that individuals go through in company with others as part of an initiation in which they collectively take part. I wonder whether the decision to zero in on the violent parts of the sequence is a conscious one, or is it one that, you know, one feels sort of inclined into by all the literature about it that does that. So that, for instance, we take partisan positions when we choose a term like mutilation or maturation on one side or the other, or an acronym like FGM, which everybody's supposed to assume has a particular meaning. There's only one of those meanings. We take a position when we speak of rights instead of speaking of adulthood. We take a position when we speak of infringement instead of initiation. We take a position when we speak of refugees instead of opportunity seekers or simply movers. So there are neutral terms too. Movers across boundaries. Cutting instead of mutilation or maturation. Can you tell us what sort of thinking did you go through as you decided how much context to put in and which terms to pick?
I have a mic here. Thank you. Thank you for your comments and questions. So first you asked about the kind of the story of the book. So In terms of the terms that I chose, I think I deliberately chose terms that would kind of dismantle or challenge trauma theory's notion of, you know, taken for granted notion of recognition that, you know, trauma is unspeakable and so it's a poetic. So once a victim speaks, they automatically recognize, and so the witness or the listener can actually be traumatized in the process of listening. So that's what I'm trying to destabilize here and problematize in thinking that the intersubjective dynamics between the witness and the survivor are embedded in politics and complex politics of recognition. And so I mean recognition in kind of Sadia Hardman's terms. So when does recognition really focus or zoom in on the empathizer rather than the one who needs empathy in some way? So it's that notion that actually trauma, which Kathy Karud suggested, you know, post-Vietnam War, was this kind of ethical return in literary theory after deconstruction, and that it is the way we are implicated in each other's history. But yet her reading, her very exact reading of that, in of the film Hiroshima Mon Amour, suggests a kind of a central locus for the trauma that is recognizable, which is mainly the Holocaust trauma, or trauma that is located in the West. So then when we dislocate or move trauma from its kind of a, this standard paradigmatic status as being from the West or the Holocaust at the central paradigm, what happens? How do the contextual issues play into, or even how does, you know, the embodiment of a certain subject or survivor prevent or prohibit recognition? So that's why I chose these terms. But I haven't really thought. I've been actually, when I was, you know, extracting parts of the chapter and making it into this talk, I thought, well, I'm not very clear about my use of FGM with this excision. But I found myself that I am more inclined to use excision than FGM. And so in the discourse then, when I mentioned kind of the discourse about naming and that the name should be FGC for some feminist activists, it is an attempt to capture the violence of it, but then it also kind of undermines other, you know, contextual issues.
Thank you, Professor Diouf. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Emily Doof, Assistant Professor of English at Brandeis University. Professor Doof's lecture was titled On Whose Terms? African Women and Politics of Recognition in the International Refugee Regime, and was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies African Studies Center. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor Emeritus of Political Science Edouard Boustan. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Lee Shuna. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.